Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by Ursula Hackett, who's the author of America's Voucher Politics, How Elites Learn to Hide the State. This is published by Cambridge University Press in 2020 and was recently awarded the American Political Science Association 2021 Education, Policy, and Politics Section Best Book Award. So I'm very honored to be talking to Ursula about this award-winning book. My first question for Ursula is to ask her a little bit about herself and how she came to this particular project about vouchers and a sort of submerged state.
Great. Thank you so much, Lily. I'm delighted to be able to talk to you. A little bit about myself, and then I'll talk to you a bit about how I came into this project. I took all my degrees at Oxford, and then I went on to do a postdoc at the Rothermere American Institute in Oxford, which is an absolutely stellar place for the study of American politics outside of the United States. And then I went on to get a job at Royal Holloway, University of London, and that's where I am now. So the book, really, the genesis of the book was at that time when I was a postdoc at the American Institute. And I came into contact with a number of brilliant Americanists, people like Nigel Bowles, people like Desmond King, some people that I co-author with today, and also with a number of visiting professors from the US and elsewhere. And the project itself grew out of a whole variety of research trips to US state capitals across the country over a period of around 8 years, from 2010 onwards. So from that year in which Barack Obama experienced his midterm shellacking and the significance, that there's a huge significance of that 2010 period of time and the subsequent period for Republican ascendance for the sort of stories I'm telling about voucher politics in this book. And I'm interested in school vouchers for a whole variety of different reasons. They've been in existence in the United States for at least 70 years, 150, 160 years, if you count the town tuitioning programs in Maine and Vermont. But they present, I think, a really interesting set of puzzles for political scientists because of the way in which they absolutely exploded in number after 2010, despite the constitutional obstacles that those programs face, the sort of legal obstacles that they face, whether from the points of First Amendment law, religious establishment, and so on, but also on grounds of equal protection, discrimination, and of educational adequacy and uniformity and so on. So there's a whole load of different interesting puzzles, I think, that this the existence and the expansion of voucher programs present to us as political scientists. And they're also an interesting case of policy design because they take many different forms. You've got vouchers, you've got tax credit voucher programs, you've got educational savings accounts. And there are various creative ways in which policymakers have designed these programs with a view to thinking about the legal consequences of what they're doing. And finally, I just say that I'm also interested in the instance of vouchers because they invoke America's foundational identity struggles over race, over religion, over the role of markets and unions and civic institutions. So as an American political development scholar, this is an absolutely perfect subject of investigation.
And I was delighted to read through your book because I had done work a long time ago in like a past political science life on the base realignment and closing commission and how that was kind of obscuring responsibility for decisions that were not popular. But it wasn't about the legal issues. Your book sort of takes this question of both the rhetoric and the policy design and sort of talks about how they're trying to obscure something else. What is it that essentially you talk about as attenuated politics? What is being obscured and what do you mean by attenuated politics?
Fantastic. Okay, so the conceptual apparatus of this book, this idea of attenuated governance, is absolutely central. And what I mean by that roughly is that we're thinking about the use of private organizations or the tax system to deliver particular benefits in such a way that you can obscure the role of the state in particularly vulnerable policy commitments and areas of hot button constitutional contestation. Now, you're quite right, Lily. The vast majority of the scholarship on the submerged state or delegated governance or hidden welfare state is focused on the public understanding angle. And it's hugely consequential how much the public or how little the public actually knows about these benefits and their nature and the scope of the state. That has huge policy and political consequences. But what I'm focusing on here is on the legal angle. And that's where attenuated governance really comes in. So what the policymakers can try to do through these forms of attenuated governance. Let me give you some examples. I think we need to make this concrete to our listeners here. So you can have regular vouchers where instead of appropriating the money directly, if you give the money directly to the private school, to the religious school, that would be patently unconstitutional, not only under First Amendment, but also under the state no aid provisions or Blaine amendments, which prohibit public aid to denominational institutions. So you can design a policy in a more attenuated fashion by providing the money to the parents and allowing the parents to direct through their private individual choice those particular educational benefits. But you can do it in an even more attenuated fashion. So a regular voucher is a directly appropriated the money, but you can do it through tax credit voucher scholarships as well, where you, instead of directly appropriating the money, you deduct taxation from donations to these organizations called scholarship tuition organizations, which then administer the scholarship to the parent to spend on behalf of the child. It is incredibly complex and convoluted chain that attenuates, that's why I'm calling it attenuated governance, attenuates that connection between the state on the one hand and the private school on the other. Now, that has legal consequences. It's not the same mechanism as pertains in the area of public understanding, electoral politics, because judges aren't fooled about the size and scope of these programs. They have that information. A court of law is an arena that is a high information arena. But what it does do is provide a rationale in favor of the constitutionality of these programs that may or may not stand up in court. Because what you can say as an advocate for these policies is that it's not the state. The state is not involved. The government is not involved in providing these benefits. And that can allow judges and justices to come to a determination about the constitutionality of these programs that may go in your favor.
And so the legal dimension is really what you dig into in the book. But before we get into this legal dimension, which I think is, as you say, very complex in terms of its arrangement, you note at the beginning of the book that this area of policy and also the construction of attenuated governance is really also part of or built on these three dimensions of American political development and American sort of qualities and characteristics around religion, race, and institutional sort of history and structure and what we expect of the state. Can you talk a little bit about that framing?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that drew me to vouchers in the first place is because it is a perfect sort of camera lens for thinking about these broader foundational identity struggles that have been present since the very founding moment, if not before, which is and this is where it becomes very firmly a work of American political development, I think. And because I'm thinking in terms of this very long historical sweep. And the fundamental intuition behind this idea of foundational identity struggles is that there's continuous contestation over the meaning of what it is to be American. And neither side in these foundational identity struggles ever fully wins out over the others. So there might be periods of time in American history where you've got one side or the other in ascendance, but then the sort of pendulum swings back and that there are various ways in which those ideas become delegitimized and other ideas come and take their place. So it's a very broad brush vision of American political development and history. So you've got a racial struggle, which of course is a defining characteristic of American political development and history, between those who have historically sought to erect strict racial hierarchies and to defend them, and those who have sought, on the other hand, to demolish those racial hierarchies and promote racially egalitarian ideas. Of course, I'm not the first person to have thought about this. My colleague Desmond King has written with Roger Smith very eloquently about the relationship between white supremacist orders and racial egalitarianism, and how those different orders have fought with one another over the course of American political history, with huge consequences for every aspect of American politics and policy. But there are other foundational identity struggles which I think interlace with that racial struggle in really interesting ways. So there's a religious struggle, of course, which was also present at the founding moment and prior to that founding moment, between those on the one hand who are accommodationist, who believe that government should promote the greatest religious flourishing, and on the other hand, the secularist urge, which says that government, state and church should be separate. And you see that's a struggle playing out at the founding moment and also over the history of American politics. And then there's a third struggle, which I'm calling the sort of public-private struggle, between those on the one hand who think that, you know, individuals should be free as far as possible from an overweening state, get the government off our backs, and then on the other hand, communitarians, which again have this long history in American political tradition, those who think that government should build civic institutions for the collective good. So the interaction between these different foundational struggles, I think, gives rise to some of the political dynamics that I discuss in the book. And in particular, the question that arises at the intersection of these foundational identity struggles is, what do you do as an elite who adheres to these various political commitments, someone as an accommodationist, as an individualist, as a white supremacist? What do you do when you start to see alternative ideas, rival ideas, gaining a degree of control within an authority within the institutions of the state? So what do you do? Well, what do you do as a white supremacist when Jim Crow seems to start to be dismantled and you have the instantiation of racially egalitarian ideas in the middle of the 20th century by the courts? What do you do as an accommodationist after many, many decades of ascendance within the public school system, but also in various other ways, when the Supreme Court starts to hew towards a much more strictly separationist vision of church-state relations? What do you do? And there's various different ways in which you can respond. So you could fight directly and run the risk of major losses in court. You can back down from these commitments, but of course these commitments are foundational. They are central to your sort of vision of who you are and what this nation is. Or, and here's an alternative vision, and that's what I outline in the book, you can act indirectly. So you can think, okay, so are there various subtle, under the radar ways in which we might be able to achieve what we want to do without arousing that sort of, or raising the prospect of legal challenge quite so much. So I think when it comes to vouchers, we can absolutely trace that history as the story initially in the 50s and the 60s of white supremacists, segregationists who say, okay, we've got a whole series of racial egalitarian ideas that are clearly in the ascendance in the federal courts. What can we do to try to preserve our policy commitments? Well, they do all sorts of, some of them fight directly, of course, but others seek indirect and subtle ways of achieving their aims. They say, oh, well, we're going to privatise our white primaries. We're going to transfer public pools and recreation facilities to private hands in such a way that we try to distance the state from these newly vulnerable policy commitments. And we create segregationist tuition vouchers, which are going to enable white kids to escape for the private sector and try to achieve our aims that way. And I draw an analogy with the various tactics that are used also by accommodationists who say, OK, well, we've tried various ways in which we can support religious institutions, religious education. We're being pushed back by First Amendment law, by state no aid provisions. What can we do? Well, we can create voucher programs. But if those don't work, well, we can create tax credit voucher programs, which are allow us to provide funding for the sorts of education that we want to provide funding for, but in a way that doesn't involve a direct appropriation, doesn't involve the state's mark, the imprimatur of the state. And so we can hope to actually defend them from challenge from rival ideas and institutions.
And one of the points that you make in the book is also that this is not just one side, the political partisanship on one side, that this the sort of attenuated governance is something that has been pursued by conservatives and liberals, by Democrats and Republicans, and with different sort of desires as the outcome, obviously, but that it's not just the activity of one side. At the same time, as you note, that 2010 is an important sort of jumping off point. Can you discuss a little bit about this sort of different partisan approaches, as well as why 2010 and the Obama shellacking and the Republican ascendancy in the states is important?
Sure. Yeah. So there's two really interesting questions there. I mean, I think the story of the rise of vouchers in their various forms is the story of conservatives finding creative, strategic ways to avoid successful legal challenge. But what I do try and emphasize in the book is that these strategies are not only available to conservatives. And actually, there have been situations in which liberals have pursued their aims through these attenuated mechanisms. So, for instance, in the case of housing vouchers, that's something I talk a little bit about in the book, which has got a very different partisan profile in terms of the people who support these sorts of policies to school vouchers. And I think the story there is partly one of racial egalitarians who find during the 80s, you've got the sort of backlash against the Great Society. You've got a sort of concerns about sort of direct affirmative action programs and so on, a sort of backlash at that during that decade. And so one of the ways in which you can help, in particular, low-income African-Americans is to support housing voucher programs, which instead of provide sort of direct funding for public housing projects, which might attract more of pushback, you can turn to these sorts of more attenuated housing voucher programs. And there are various other ways, we can talk about these more if you'd like, Lily, but there are other ways in which liberals more recently have used these sorts of attenuation mechanisms in court to try to defend their programs from attack. But the big story with respect to school vouchers certainly has been conservatives really being very creative about this. And in 2010, that's the big moment where they spot their chance and they see because of the way in which Republicans gain control of so many state houses at that time, they've got unified control and they're able to actually start to prosecute their agenda, a whole load of things, of course, right to work, as well as school voucher programs. And that's really when you start to see not only the increase in the number of regular voucher programs, but also tax credit voucher programs really take off. What I'm able to show in the book is not just it's a mixed methods book. I should say it's a story of American political development. So I'm using a lot of archival materials, but I've also got some statistical relationships in there and statistical analysis of some original data sets that I've collected on policymakers and on judges. And there you can see that Republican partisanship is a really important part of the predictors of both policymakers voting in favor of these things, but then also later of judicial decisions. And we might come onto that in a moment, perhaps. But it's not just about the statistical side of things. It's also the interviews. And this is where I can really shed light on what happened in 2010 and afterwards. Because you can see by talking to individual policymakers and across the states that they're thinking in a very creative and strategic way about how they can best create programs that will survive legal challenge. And so they're going back to the drawing board. They're going, okay, this one didn't work, right? We had that struck down by court action. What can we do? How can we design this program in such a way that it will withstand future legal challenges? So the thing that happens in 2010 is, yes, Republicans gain control. They're able to prosecute their agenda, but you know, they've still got to worry about the courts. They've still got to worry about a whole load of judges and justices who are going to be deciding the constitutionality of their program. So I do happen to believe that policymakers care about policy and they care about preserving their policy commitments into the future. So it's not just about passing these things. It's also about, okay, how can we preserve this from legal challenge down the road?
And I found that point that you made really important to think about, because you're right. Most of the time we think about policy, it needs to pass, right? And we have this gridlock system these days where it's almost impossible to get at the federal level things passed. But you're talking about not just that part, obviously the design of the policy and having the sufficient votes, as you talk about in the state houses, but then that has to be sustained afterwards when the legal challenges come. And this is where you also talk about the policy design, the attenuated nature of the design, not that it was attenuated in its designing, but that it is designed to be attenuated governance, as well as attenuated rhetoric. So before we get into the judges and the court challenges, can you sort of unpack these dimensions of attenuated governance?
Sure. So I think the idea here is to think about these two analytically separable dimensions. These dimensions don't necessarily go hand in hand all the time. So that's the crucial insight there. There's the policy design dimension, which I've been talking a lot about, and that is this when you use the private system or the tax system to deliver the benefit, and you have this very convoluted, attenuated chain between the state on the one hand and the private school on the other. But there's also this idea of attenuating rhetoric. And that's really simply where you're trying to play down the role that the state is playing in a particular area of policy. And one of the interesting things to look at is the situations in which the attenuating rhetoric and the attenuated design don't match up. I've talked a bit about the segregationists and their tuition grant vouchers, which are amongst the first iterations of these programs in the 50s and the 60s after Brown v. Board. They're going, oh, cripes, how are we going to defend this institution? Well, the big problem for the segregationists, although they engage in incredible acts of attenuated policy design, so they create these programs. Often they get struck down by court action multiple times. Louisiana, they had four different rewrites of this law. It got struck down each time and they kept coming back to the drawing board and they go, okay, what can we do? Well, we can create private commissions to administer these programs. We offer the money not directly to the school, but to the parent, and they can direct that to the school. So there's a fair degree of attenuated policy design, but the segregationists are pretty open about their purposes in supporting segregation. They say, we're going to do this despite the brainwashers and the communists. This is to keep our schools segregated. I mean, you know, they're unable to obscure their purposes. And here's the thing, you can trace this to the courts. I mean, the judges then say, well, look, there's a disjuncture here. You've got this incredibly complex and very carefully designed policy in many cases, but, you know, it's pretty obvious what you're trying to do. And it's very obvious that you are, you are violating the Constitution. And so on that basis, they strike it down. So, okay, you know, conservatives watch and learn. They see that this is obviously not the way to do it. And then there are more recently, you get these iterations of these more direct vouchers, the sorts of things that were created in Cleveland and in Milwaukee in the 90s, and which were then sort of subsequently attacked in court all the way up to the Supreme Court, culminating in the big Zelman versus Simmons-Harris decision with the Supreme Court, which actually ultimately upheld the constitutionality of these programs. Those programs survived, but there were many other efforts on the sort of regular voucher programs, which provides a fairly obvious connection between the state and the school. You know, you're just directly appropriating the money for these things, which did get struck down as unconstitutional. They're more likely to be challenged in court, and then if they are challenged, they're more likely to be struck down as unconstitutional. So, again, the big story there is that when in 2010 Republicans gained control of a whole bunch of state legislatures and governorships, what they're aiming to do is to marry these strategies of attenuated policy design and attenuating rhetoric. So they say, okay, we're going to play down the role of the state. We're going to emphasize the benefits to the child a lot of the times. And that is both a political rallying cry, one that's very powerful, I think. We put the focus on the children. We don't put the focus on the schools. And we're very careful about how we speak about these programs. And I have many, many situations where I was with my interviewees and they say, gosh, don't say voucher. We never say voucher. That's a dirty word. We don't use the word voucher. Everyone's saying this. But they're very careful about how they speak about these programs. And they say this is about the benefits of the child. So it's a political rallying cry, but it's also a legal slogan as well, and one that actually does very well in court. If you can say that you have child benefit theory, is the theory that if you provide the benefit to the child and not directly to the institution, that benefit is constitutional in a way that the direct appropriation would not be. So I think the big story about this rapid explosive growth in the number of voucher programs after 2010 is the success. They hit upon the right formula. They know that they need to marry the policy design with the rhetoric. You need to be careful about how you talk about the state, and you need to design your program in such a way that there's a non-obvious involvement of the state in this private conduct.
And the involvement of the state is the tricky part in all of this, is that because if the state is too connected to what's going on and the outcome is one that is in violation of aspects of either state or federal constitution, then it's likely to be struck down. And you talk a lot about how the sort of attenuated governance has to separate the state, even though the state is still involved, which seems to be the kind of magic that is going on in these policy areas. How has the state been kind of divorced from the policy?
Well, this is a live issue of contestation. And this is why, you know, there are different schools of thought within what's called tax expenditure analysis about whether these benefits really do truly represent a state, like a government policy. And it's a conservative liberal split right now. So you kind of have there's a famous Supreme Court decision in 2010, which was Arizona Christian School Tuition Organization versus Wynn, in which the conservatives on the one hand argued that these targeted tax breaks are basically this is not the state. So a tax credit scholarship is private money, effectively. It's not public monies, it's private monies. The liberals, on the other hand, said, well, you know, targeted tax breaks and direct appropriations are means of accomplishing precisely the same objective, to provide a particular benefit to a particular constituency. And so that is a live arena of contestation about whether indeed the state is unconstitutionally entangled with these issues. I mean, that's the foundation of all of this, these legal controversies. But what I think the current case law tells us, and what those two major Supreme Court precedents tell us, the Zelman case and, of course, the Wynn case, is that the state is not involved, and this is actually not a government social program. That's in the ascendance right now, and the liberal vision of tax breaks as being equivalent in lots of ways to government spending has sort of is less in favor.
And the current Supreme Court in the United States, as well as the state courts, where have they come down and where are they? You say this is like this is where they are in ascendance right now. And the judges, and how much information judges have and the courts have in unpacking these, How does that operate?
Okay, so you can see these battles playing out in the judicial opinions, and you can see how amongst concurrences and dissents, you can see how judges are actually thinking about these issues. And I look in my book at over 70 years of voucher litigation. So I've got the huge swath of time where you're looking at judges and justices and how they are deciding, not only in the federal level, of course, but also at the state level where a whole load of this is going on. You can see the turns of the tide in these broad, across these broad swaths of time. So I would say so that over time, you can see that judges and justices have become more sympathetic over time to these programs, voucher programs of all sorts, tax credit voucher programs, educational savings accounts, and so on. And I use the term voucher as a shorthand for all of these different kinds of designs. And I think partly that's because of supportive precedents being built up over time. But also I think of advocates and policymakers being much more careful and strategic about how they are talking about these programs and how they are designing these programs in such a way, anticipating the legal challenge. So it's an iterative, creative process that's played out over many years. So judges are becoming more sympathetic over time. There is also a statistically significant effect of partisanship, which I mentioned just before. Republican appointed judges and justices are statistically significantly more likely to vote to uphold these programs as constitutional than their democratic appointed counterparts. Well, that's not a surprise because we know that the partisanship of this issue is very, very strong. What is interesting, and this is the point on which this book hinges, is that even controlling for partisanship and for a variety of other judicial characteristics, there is a statistically significant role for policy design. So the programs which hide the role of the state most successfully are not only more likely to pass in legislatures, but they're also less likely to be challenged. And if they are challenged, they're more likely to be upheld as constitutional. So it's kind of like a triple whammy for the supporters of these programs that they're able to, it has that effect at each of these different stages. And you can show how that plays out over time.
And the policy design aspect, which again is really where you highlight the attenuated governance dimension that is part of this longer discussion of the submerged state and obscured results. How can we understand the changes in the policy design that you highlight so in such depth in terms of making it more disconnected from the state,
making the school more disconnected from the state,
making the school and the whole process of, you know, when we're talking about money goes to schools from, you know, from my state house in Madison, it goes to my local school, and that's how it generally works. But what you're talking about is how are these policies being designed so as to sort of structure the money to go to the school, and how has it become more effective, even as it seems to be also quite complex?
Sure. So, I mean, I think that I really want to make a clear distinction in the book between the electoral arena and the judicial arena, in the sense that I think, as I mentioned before, I mean, I don't think informational asymmetry plays a very big role in terms of making a determination of how judges are going to rule on these things. But it plays a huge role in the electoral arena because informational asymmetry is between the public and the sort of interest groups that are really engaged in these areas is causally very significant in that arena. So I think that it's not necessarily, I make no determination in the book about whether it is indeed true that the government is, you know, whether these legal arguments have merit or not. You know, I don't actually come down on either side of that debate. I simply observe that it's been instrumentally very useful for these policymakers and for advocates on behalf of these policies to at least be seen to to break the link between the state and the school. Okay, so it's all about appearances. I'm agnostic on the question of whether those legal arguments have merit. The point is that they work, that actually it's possible for these arguments to be made in court, and judges seem to accept them. Now, I'm not also making any determination in the book about whether those judges are cynical in their approach or whether this is indeed a sneaky... I mean, there's a whole load of interest. I mean, a lot of the scholarship, a lot of the revisionist scholarship on the welfare state has kind of got... There's a very clear normative angle there, right? This is a sneaky means of achieving objectives. It hides the just and due role of the state. The state should be given more credit. That's kind of the angle, isn't it, of a lot of this scholarship. I don't mean to make a normative judgment, or at least I hope I don't make a normative judgment in this book, but I simply observe that judges, whether for sincere reasons or cynical ones, are taking up these rationales, and you can trace the relationship between the sort of rationales that advance in the political arena and also by the policymakers themselves, by advocates, and by the judges. So there is the argument is that you can break that connection. I might be skipping ahead a little bit here, but some of the work which I'm working on now as a sort of function of my work on attenuated governance is the various other arenas in which you can de-link the sort of controversial policy purposes, intentions, programs, and effects in all sorts of different areas of hot button constitutional controversy, not just school vouchers, but in abortion politics, in gun control politics, in voting rights, and a whole host of other different areas. So I think that this rationale of sort of attenuating the connection between the state on the one hand and then the ultimate object of that policy on the other has been found to be very successful. And it's something that policymakers, I think, seek to take up in prosecuting the case.
That was going to be my next question, is how transferable is this process to other areas, other policy areas that are potentially controversial, as you note, that like gun rights or abortion rights or voting rights and so forth. How does this particular model for policy design and attenuation work for those particular areas?
So there's a very clear disanalogy in the sense that when it comes to things like abortion politics or gun control, we're not talking here about, it's all about regulations. It's not about attenuation. It's not about necessarily providing funds through a tax expenditure mechanism. But it is, there are analogies in the sense that it is politically and legally expedient for policymakers to play down the connection between authoritative government action and particularly controversial policy outcomes. So let me give you an example. I mean, we're thinking about abortion politics, and the constitutional right at issue here, of course, is one that is currently defended by U.S. Supreme Court precedent under Roe. And so an outright ban on abortion would be unconstitutional, but there are various ways in which you can circumscribe that right by targeting not only individual women through informed consent laws and so on, waiting periods and a whole variety of other different things, but also through targeting clinics and targeting regulation of abortion providers and providing for hospitalization requirements on the part of those people performing abortions in those facilities, but also corridor widths, sanitary requirements, a whole load of different things that can be applied to the clinics. And the effect of many of these policies is to reduce the ability of those clinics to actually operate in particular jurisdictions, in some cases just closing entirely in whole states. So that can have the same effect, but in a way that doesn't necessarily directly challenge the constitutional right. Now, I would also say, and this is where I don't mean to suggest that this is just conservatives who are focusing on these things, but also in the policies of gun control. I mean, you know, a direct, under DC versus Heller, there is a constitutional right to carry, and so a direct ban upon guns would be unconstitutional. What can you do? Well, there are various indirect ways in which you can circumscribe the rights of gun owners in quite inciting, just the same way as those who seek to circumscribe the right of those exercising their right to an abortion. So, for instance, through background checks and permit and licensing regimes, and you can do various things with respect to the federal firearms licensees and so on. And so what you can see with respect to both of these areas of hot button constitutional contestation, and that's where the voucher analogy comes in, because, of course, school choice is another hot button area of constitutional contestation. There is a legal expedient to seeking to de-link those any sort of sense that there is a policy, unconstitutional policy purposes, but also of effect. So you can say this isn't truly a burden upon women or upon gun owners, because it would only affect a very small number of people. And we're not directly impinging upon that right. Or it could be that we're not actually seeking to infringe upon these constitutional rights. No, we're seeking to aid women's health, or we are seeking to, we've got common sense firearm safety regulations, or we've got a benefit to a child and it's not to the school. So there are all sorts of ways in which you can talk about these things in such a way that if you can persuade the judges and justices that those anodyne reasons represent your reasons for acting, you can find that that's very helpful in court. And I can show you again statistically that over 50 years or more of litigation on these issues, again, partisanship plays a huge role. So Republican judges and justices more likely to vote in favor of abortion restrictions and of striking down as unconstitutional gun restrictions. But there is a very important role to be played by policy design as well. And those policies that most effectively mask the connection between authoritative state action and the exercise of your constitutional rights at the other end of the chain, even if it's through regulatory mechanisms rather than through the sort of attenuated governance mechanisms I'm describing in my book, I think there is an analogy there, and I think it's a story that needs to be told.
And this is a sidebar question, my own curiosity, and because so much is being written these days about neoliberalism and this question of choice and freedom, that how much of this idea of attenuated governance is also kind of in this neoliberal framework?
I spend so much time in my book talking about the ways in which both conservatives and liberals can access and use these techniques. I just say this very quickly, because I think this is a fascinating question about neoliberalism, but I just want to quickly say that there's this point about foundational identity struggles about race and religion and white supremacy and communitarianism and individualism and accommodation and so on. What I'm talking about there is those are foundational. So those are sort of about the ultimate aims. You don't give up those aims because you care about those. Those are basic to your vision of yourself as a political actor. But I think that my vision of politics is one in which policymakers and advocates are actually quite strategic and creative and instrumental about how they get there a lot of the time. I mean, there's different ways in which you might you might feel that the means is a sneaky thing, and so there are various people who object to the means because they think that it's sneaky to do things in an underhand sort of indirect way, and that actually we ought to be open about our policy purposes and honest about what we're doing philosophically. So there are people who have said that to me and who are in this debate and who make that argument. But I think on the whole, many of the people that I talk to and many of my vision of how this has played out over time is that policymakers are quite instrumental about different ways of getting there. So however you can get there, the ends justify the means, and whatever that end happens to be on different sides. Okay, so I make a whole point about conservatives and liberals. They do both on various occasions used these techniques. But I think your point about neoliberalism is absolutely on point, Lily, which is that these are accessible. They are more easily accessible, I would say, to those who are on the conservative side of the spectrum. And I would say that this absolutely fits in with the story about the rise of neoliberalism in various different arenas of politics and political life. I think the interesting story now, and the one that I think that I need to sort of grapple with as the sort of coda to the book is what happens when a lot of those forces actually win out, and this has been a story about electoral winners who fear that they're going to be legal losers, but now they're not legal losers. There's a whole load of ways in which the conservatives have been pushing back in court, and you start to see, I mentioned Zelman, I mentioned Wynne, but recently we've had 2017, the Supreme Court came out in Trinity Lutheran versus Comer, that the no aid provision in Missouri is unconstitutional, that actually it's not right that this private religious school should not be allowed to take part in a playground resurfacing program from the state, excluded on free exercise grounds, not on establishment grounds. And then only last year, also, there was the Espinoza decision versus Montana, in which it was found that the Montana state could not exclude religious schools from that program. It's not about the establishment concern, but it's about the exclusion of religious schools from that particular program. The story, I think, is of conservative ascendance more generally, and ways in which now perhaps there is a lessened necessity of conducting your business in this indirect way, because you feel that you can achieve your aims more directly, perhaps, confident that there is a secure legal cushion that will prevent you from experiencing loss in court.
So that the sort of longer line of precedent at this point is more protective of both the need for obscuring rhetoric and possibly obscuring designs.
I think that's, yeah. I mean, well, I think that's right, but I think that it's no longer required for you to actually engage to quite such degree as has hitherto been the case in these sorts of indirect approaches. So I think one of the manifestations of that is the spread of educational savings accounts, and those are a more in general they are a slightly more less complex way of achieving the same aim, and they've been spreading quite rapidly, including in particular this year. I mean, the pandemic has it's put rocket boosters under school choice. You've had 18 states that have actually either created new programs or they've expanded their existing ones. Including some states that I went to. I mean, Missouri was an interesting one. I spent some time in Jefferson City, the Jeff, and it was a very interesting experience there, because there I was looking at a case where, despite the fact that this is a ruby red, Republican-controlled state, they hadn't passed any kind of voucher or tax credit program. And I was thinking, well, why? Why didn't these? I mean, Texas is another example, and Texas is a really interesting case as well. It's surrounded by voucher adopters, but they've never actually adopted any kind of voucher program. And this is such a partisan issue that I sort of wanted to get to the grips with that. And the story there was really one about rural Republican legislators kind of combining these really interesting, strange bedfellow alliances with Democrats in order to defeat these programs, because for a whole load of different reasons, which I don't necessarily need to go into right now. But what's interesting is Missouri has just passed their educational savings accounts program this year. So it's huge, because I've met a lot of these people who've been pushing and pushing and pushing for a decade or more, and then they've experienced this success. So there's a big story here, I think, about the pandemic pushing the school choice cause. But I think it is a broader story also of that supportive legal precedent of judges and justices who over time have built up this case law on this subject. And those rationales are very easy and available. It puts teacher unions in particular, and those on the liberal side of the argument, on the back foot. And it makes it more difficult for them to succeed in court in their challenges.
So my final question, of course, is what are you working on now? Is it an extension of this research or something completely different?
Right. So I mentioned the case of abortion and gun control. I mean, I want to think more generally about the quiverful of strategic arrows that policymakers have in their armory. What can they do? What are the sort of strategic options and the creative options that are available to them in different areas of policymaking that enable them to deal with the prospect, the possibility of legal challenge from their opponents? And I think this is absolutely, this is so timely, because the courts have become very, very important. You mentioned early on in some of your remarks, of just the hyper-partisanship, the polarization, the stasis, the difficulty of achieving legislative success at the federal level, the way in which the we've got all these narrow electoral majorities, right? Frequent changes of control. So there's a sort of, it doesn't encourage, it encourages you to turn towards the courts. So the courts become even more important now than they have always, and they've always been crucial, but they've become even more important, I think, today in this era of hyperpolarization and of frequent changes of control. And so what I'm interested in is looking at what policymakers do in these circumstances. How do they think about, how do they navigate this world, this strategic landscape? And I think it would also be interesting, and I'd like to think more generally also on an abstract and conceptual level about how we understand modes of policymaking change in historical institutionalism. So I am an American political development person at heart. That's another, I think, a more sort of conceptual discussion that I think we need to have that takes stock of the enormous value of the scholarship on the submerged state and of the delegated state and of the hidden welfare state that has been published over the last couple of decades.
Well, I hope when one of these are published as a book, you'll come back and talk to me about them.
I hope so. Thank you.
I was joined today by Ursula Hackett, author of America's Voucher Politics, How Elites Learn to Hide the State, which won the APSA 2021 Education Policy and Politics Section Best Book Award. This is published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. I assume one can buy this at Cambridge University Press website. Any brick and mortar store with an online presence you want to give a shout out to?
Blackwell's Oxford.
Okay, there you go. Thank you for joining me all the way from the UK, Ursula.
Thank you so much, Lily. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.